You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us here today on the Ideas Network. Governor Scott Walker signed a $3 billion incentive package on Monday as a way to solidify a deal between the state and the Taiwanese electronics manufacturer Foxconn. Foxconn is slated to build a factory in southeastern Wisconsin. Supporters of that plan say it could create some 13,000 jobs. But in a memo from the nonpartisan Wisconsin Legislative Council, the group found that some provision in the state's incentive package could be unconstitutional. Laurel White joins us now. She's the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Laurel, welcome back to Central Time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about the provisions in this Foxconn deal that were reviewed here. They all relate to the courts and how the courts would treat challenges to Foxconn. Can you talk about what's in this incentive package that's at question here?
That's right. So this language has been tweaked a little bit over the evolution of the Foxconn incentive package. When it was originally introduced, it would have required the Supreme Court to take up court cases involving Foxconn if they were appealed and reached that, you know, kind of that threshold. It also would have placed an immediate stay on circuit court rulings. So the lowest court, if that decision was appealed, their ruling would automatically be stayed or blocked after the judge issued it. So that was kind of the first iteration. This was something that, when it was introduced as an amendment in the Joint Finance Committee, which was the Senate's committee for the Foxconn package, Democrats really pushed back on it, and they said that it kind of rigged the system, those were their words, and created an unfair advantage for Foxconn and special treatment, a special legal process for the company that other companies in Wisconsin aren't subject to. So that actually, that was approved by the committee. After that debate, Republicans who have the majority on the Joint Finance Committee voted it through. And when the Foxconn bill came up in the Senate, on the Senate floor, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald introduced some small tweaks to the legal language for the judicial process. So as it stands right now, and as it is law that was signed by the governor on Monday, that immediate stay of circuit court rulings is still in place. So if a judge issues a ruling and it's appealed to a higher court, the appellate court, that ruling is automatically blocked. And there are some things, some elements that speed up the process for getting the case to the state Supreme Court. There's a timeline for appeals that dates that things, certain things have to be filed by. And then there's also some language in there that requires the Supreme Court to give these cases preference. It doesn't require them to take them, but it requires them to kind of consider them in a different way, weigh whether or not they're going to take them in a different way than other cases.
And now we've got this new report on the potential constitutional challenges to these provisions. First of all, who's this report coming from?
So it's coming from the nonpartisan legal office for the state legislature. It's called the Legislative Council. And this memo was requested by the Democratic leader in the state Senate, Democratic Senator Jennifer Schilling, who's the minority leader there. And essentially what the memo says is that elements of the judicial process language in the Foxconn package could be up for a challenge. It doesn't say, yes, they are absolutely unconstitutional, or yes, they are absolutely constitutional. It just sort of says there's room to make an argument there if someone did want to challenge it in court.
And the potential grounds for that argument, as I understand the report, and this is some fairly complex legal stuff, but if I've got this right, there's this idea of separation of powers. The legislature gets to do this, the governor gets to do this, and the judicial system gets to do this other stuff. And the challenge might be along the lines of, hey, this is the legislature and the governor moving on in on judicial turf, and maybe that's a violation of the state constitution. Do I have that basically right?
Yes, I think you do. So it is pretty complicated, but yeah, it does boil down to one branch of government infringing on the core powers of another branch of government. So there are these things that are kind of considered exclusive powers of each branch. And so if the court was to find that this language infringes on that core power of the judiciary, if it was kind of a sole responsibility of the judiciary, it would be found to be unconstitutional. Now, there are also things called shared powers, where there are things that the legislature and the judiciary kind of collaborate on and influence each other on. And if this language is found to be within that shared powers realm, it could still be found to be unconstitutional if it places an undue burden on the judiciary. So there are a couple different arguments here and kind of different complicated layers of government that would be at play.
We're talking to Laurel White, State Capitol reporter for WPR News, looking at possible constitutional challenges to a part of the Foxconn incentive package, a part that would expedite cases involving challenges to Foxconn. And Laurel, those cases, these provisions move things quickly to the state Supreme Court. A legal challenge to these provisions would be in the state court system, which means they'd probably ultimately be decided by the state Supreme Court. It all goes to the same place, right?
Right. So the Supreme Court would be making a decision about their process, kind of making a decision about themselves, which is a little meta.
I was going to say, very, very meta justice here.
Right, exactly. So it could get pretty wonky, even more wonky and complicated if the challenge is mounted and starts moving through the court system.
Well, let's look at the response to this report and what people are saying about the constitutionality this week. What have we heard from Governor Walker and the state attorney general?
Well, we got statements yesterday from the governor and the attorney general saying that they have faith in this law. They think it's constitutional. They stand behind it. The governor said that this legal language helps have expeditious legal processes that don't, I think his word was stonewall Foxconn and stand in the way of thousands of jobs that would be at the facility, that are projected to be at the facility. And Attorney General Brad Schimmel said essentially the same thing, that he thinks it would certainly pass constitutional muster if it was to be challenged in court. He cited, not in his statement, but in some additional information that he sent with his statement, sort of federal processes that are similar to this in terms of automatic stays and judicial responsibilities, kind of who gets to decide what and things like that. So I think the governor and the attorney general are both pretty confident if this were to go to the courts that it would prevail.
And one of the motivations politically seems to be, hey, we've got this great opportunity to bring all these jobs into the state. Let's not risk thwarting it, slowing it down, maybe even stopping it because of, I don't know if the word frivolous was used, but because of potential frivolous legal challenges related to Foxconn.
Right, exactly. I don't remember if the word frivolous was used either, but I wouldn't be surprised, because I think that that kind of fairly encapsulates the argument, especially from the governor, about these lawsuits, that they're interested in having the process move quickly because the stakes are high, the thousands of jobs. And back in the committee, when Republican lawmakers were arguing in favor of this change, they said, you know, hey, it's good for both parties. It's good for Foxconn, and it's good for whoever the other party in the lawsuit is, because this moves it quickly, gets it to the Supreme Court more quickly, gets a decision for folks, and then they can kind of move on with their lives.
And how about critics of this, Democrats who voted against it and others who are worried about these provisions? What have you heard?
So Democrats are really just echoing that original argument against the language back from the committee. They're just reiterating that they think this kind of rigs the system, that it creates an unfair advantage for Foxconn, that it places a stronger importance on this big business than the people of Wisconsin, who might be the other party, you know, if it's an individual or a family, if it has to do with eminent domain or something like that, that Foxconn would have an advantage because of this law in the court system, and they don't believe that that's fair.
So we probably won't see how this all shakes out until Foxconn is in the works, somebody files some kind of challenge, and then as part of that challenge, they challenge these provisions, which affect how their challenge is made. Getting meta again?
Right, exactly. I think, you know, we're not, it's not new for us in Wisconsin to have complicated legal cases and multiple legal cases that interact with each other. You think about, like, the voter ID law, for example. So I think that we could be having a situation kind of like voter ID, where we've got multiple lawsuits and they're interacting with each other and they overlap a little bit. And it's definitely, if that challenge does emerge, will be complicated and interesting. And we will be here to talk through it together.
We'll talk to you then, Laurel, if not sooner, and probably sooner. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Every first Monday of the month, it's time for Mondays with Mike. WPR Director Mike Crane or WPR Director of Content Mike Arnold joins the morning show or Central Time to answer your questions. That's Mondays with Mike here on the Ideas Network.
Now, lefties and southpaws face a lot of challenges, and there's even a group that's formed at International Left-Handers Day once a year. It's aimed at raising awareness of the everyday issues that lefties face living in a world designed for right-handed people, as described here by Ned Flanders from The Simpsons.
Well, sir, like one out of every nine Americans, I'm left-handed. And let me tell you, it ain't all peaches and cream. Your writing gets smeared. Lord help you if you want to drive a standard transmission.
Amen to that.
Well, sir, I'm opening up a one-stop store for southpaws. Everything from left-handed apple peelers to left-handed zithers. Gotta call it the Leftorium.
Ooh. It's estimated that about 10% of the world's population is left-handed. And while International Left-Handers Day encourages lefties to have some fun with the whole thing, our next guest points out that there's an unfortunate dark history of left-handedness, one that still exists today.
Throughout history, he says left-handedness has been viewed as a negative trait, often associated with various forms of mental disorders. In some cases, left-handers have been retrained to use their right hand, a practice that in some parts of the world is still done today, often in gruesome ways.
Howard Kushner joins us now. He's a distinguished professor of science and society emeritus at Emory University and a professor of history emeritus at San Diego State University. His book is On the Other Hand, Left Hand, Right Brain, Mental Disorder, and History. Howard, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Veronica and Rob, for having me on.
Well, Howard, you're a lefty yourself. You're also a scientist and a social historian. Was it kind of the nexus of all these things that made you want to look into what it really means and has meant to be left-handed?
I think two things in particular. One was being left-handed. Myself, I was always curious why I was left-handed and others weren't. More, my mother was left-handed, and what I didn't realize till later was that she had been forced to switch from her left hand as a child to use her right hand for eating, sewing, and all kinds of other things. So, and writing, of course. So I wonder why that was so that it happened to her and not to me. And then when I was working on a project about 20 years ago on Tourette syndrome, I noticed that our patients at the hospital and at our clinic were more left-handed than more than 10% of Tourette's patients and attention deficit. So I wondered why that was so, and was that really true, or was that just a bias because we were dealing with people who already had a diagnosis?
This may sound like a simple question, but reading your book, maybe it is more complicated than I thought. What does it mean to be left-handed?
Well, I guess it depends on when and where you're left-handed. Right? For me, it was a positive experience because I could play baseball, hit with my left hand, throw with my left hand, and that was an advantage when I was growing up. But in most of the world's history, left-handedness has been seen as a sign of moral omission and mental inferiority. And as a result, it becomes self-fulfilling because if you expect people not to do well, you are prejudiced against them, particularly children, then you're going to have the result you predicted in the first place. So I would say that throughout human history, handedness has been a sign of these things, but actually it's not the being left-handed that matters, but the discrimination. Get rid of that and left-handers do quite well.
Getting at some of the science behind it as we try to figure out exactly what it means to be left or right-handed, it seems like there might have been a gene you might expect to be responsible for left-handedness, but it sounds like scientists are not able to find a gene. And also, you know, the traits don't really show up until kids are 3 years old. So how does this handed preference develop in the first place?
Well, that's a very good question. I wish I had the answer. But I think one of the things is when we see a behavior or something different in a population, we look for the cause as if there's a single cause. And one of the things I learned looking at left-handedness is there are probably several different routes people have to get there. And we're putting a lot of things together to make the determination someone's left-handed. So it could come someone could be could develop a disorder in part because of the social pressure. They can become left-handed because of social pressure, or right-handed because of it. But there has been a lot of work looking for the gene for left-handedness, and as happens often with scientific discoveries, someone will make a claim that they found the gene, or they think they found the gene, or they found a marker for the gene, and it'll be in the front pages of all these newspapers. And then a couple of weeks later, it turns out that other scientists don't agree, and the story sort of disappears into the history books. So it's strange for something that seems so common and so part of our society that we there's so many things we don't really know about it or understand.
Howard Kushner is with us. We're talking about left-handedness. His new book is On the Other Hand, Left Hand, Right Brain, Mental Disorder, and History. Let's talk about retraining, Howard. You write that your mother, and you just mentioned your mother, had been retrained to use her right hand for writing, sewing, and the like. What are the consequences when we retrain somebody who's left-handed to behave as though they're right-handed?
I think a really good illustration of the consequences is the life of King George VI. You may remember from the movie The King's Speech that he was forced to, he was a stutterer, and it turns out that between 7 and 8 years, he was forced to move from using his left hand to his right hand for writing and for eating. And the only place they didn't try to change it is his playing tennis for some reason. And one of the results that the king had, that many other of the patients we looked at in the 20th century, was stuttering as a result of hand switching. There's a mechanical reason why that might be so. And so the intervention to stop people from developing what were supposed to be cognitive disabilities from being left-handed, therefore making them into right-handers, actually had a negative effect much greater than whatever it was people were trying to cure. And the methods used were quite horrific. The kids' hands would be tied behind their back. They'd be put with dunce caps on. They'd be repeatedly humiliated in school. And my book talks about many of these cases, and some of them is pretty happened as late as the 1960s, which even surprised me in the United States. And there are the people from all over the Western world that have these sort of left-hander clubs recently trying to create pride in left-handedness and to claim that that many things that happened to them psychologically in their life had to do with being switched.
We're talking with Howard Kushner. His book is On the Other Hand, Left Hand, Right Brain, Mental Disorder, and History. And we're talking about why left-handedness is still so widely misunderstood and why it's been stigmatized throughout history. And Howard, looking at lists of people who are left-handed themselves, I saw Angelina Jolie, Tom Cruise, I think Barack Obama. There's a huge list, and it's tempting to say, well, what do these people have in common? And I guess that's my question for you. Do we know if they have certain traits in common, mental or otherwise?
Well, one trait they have in common, especially for the older ones, is that they persisted against that, and they were very resilient. So, you know, it turns out that as a group, left-handers both test higher and lower as a group, right? So some of the left-handers do very, very well, especially in mathematics testing, and some of them do very, very poorly. So it'd be interesting to find out what separates some from the others. But clearly, the resilience is part of it. You know that 5 of the last 10 presidents were left-handed, which is quite extraordinary when you think about it. On the other hand, which is the title of my book, of course, when we look at some of these people who are forcibly changed, and we noticed that, like with the king, there were many more stutterers. What happened in the 1930s and 40s were at the University of Iowa, where speech pathology was actually born. The leaders of the speech pathology departments wondered, instead of treating these stutterers with the way they were, what would happen if they actually took the stutterers who they knew were left-handed and had been switched and switched them back to be left-handed. And what happened was, to everyone's surprise, that their stuttering went away. So not all stutters are a result of hand switching, but a large number apparently have that relationship. And that was quite an amazing thing to read these cases and see that.
Now, stuttering, you write, over the years has been associated by many people with mental disorders, and I guess part of curing the mental disorder would be curing the so-called wrong-handedness. Has there ever been anything to that, apart from people who have been retrained, an association between being left-handed and mental disorders?
Well, it may be because, you know, we lump all left-handers together, and we shouldn't necessarily do that. And so those who are very strongly left-handed resist much more being switched back than those who are only had two or three things left-handed. Like they might throw right-handed but eat left-handed, be left-footed or be right-footed instead. So what you have is like two ends of a spectrum. Those are strongly right-handed and those are strongly left-handed. And many people, many more than just the 10%, fit into those who are sort of weakly right-handed. So it depends on how we define left-handed. And we use a simple test that's sort of reliable, but not always reliable, which people are asked 10 questions about handedness. What foot do they use? What eye do they favor? What ear do they favor? And those who get the most numbers, the highest number of left-handers become left-handed, and the others are seen as right-handed.
We're talking with Howard Kushner, author of the book, On the Other Hand, Left Hand, Right Brain, Mental Disorder, and History. We're talking about why left-handedness is still so widely misunderstood and why it's been stigmatized throughout history.
That was an encore presentation of that interview after our regular programming was briefly interrupted due to fire drill. We'll pick up our conversation later in the show, our scheduled talk about hunting without harvest. That'll be at 4:15.
Coming up after the news, we'll find out what's changed for stay-at-home dads in the U.S. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. And remember, check out the new edition of Entertain Us that's coming up tonight after 6 here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll look at a conflict between Wisconsin's governor and the state education superintendent over a new plan for schools in the state.
First, while it's still a low number, the percentage of stay-at-home dads has risen from 1% to 4% since the 1970s. And for the first time in 5 years, more dads are choosing to stay at home rather than being at home with the kids while looking for work. And today, networking groups for at-home dads are working to lessen some of the downsides, things like isolation and social stigma.
Chris Routley joins us now. He's an author, illustrator, and a board member of the National At-Home Dad Network. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
What do you say to this news that most stay-at-home dads are now staying-at-home dads by choice?
Well, what I'd say is I'm really happy to see that because that actually is exactly what we have seen play out. Our membership and organization, the attendance at our annual convention, the majority of guys are doing it by choice. They haven't been forced into it. So I'm glad to see that we finally have some numbers on there. I think one of the things we need to be careful about is how we define stay-at-home dad can often really affect these numbers. Because a lot of stay-at-home dads are doing the full-time caregiver role, but are also doing some sort of work, and so they're not counted. So there's a lot of issues like that that we try to kind of talk about, that caregiving is a job, and that if you are a full-time caregiver, that you're not out of work, I guess. So, but yeah, these numbers really, really stand up with what we see.
And I think it was especially during the recession, there were parents, fathers at home with kids because maybe they lost a job. And it seems as though the trend now is that this is something that a significant number of fathers are saying, yeah, this is what I want to do. And maybe I am doing some work from home as well. But this is a choice that's shifted things. Why do you think that choice is becoming more popular?
Well, it's funny. I get asked a lot about, or I hear pointed out the recession and there was this rise in stay-at-home dads during that, and that the issue was about the recession and that traditionally male jobs were being lost, and that's why they stayed home. And I always felt like the big story that was being missed there was how this showed what a social change had happened and was happening, because we'd had recessions before and not seen that happen. And I think it really was indicative of how men are looking at what works for their family and saying, I'm not going to tell somebody that I can't take care of my kid. And so, yes, that recession definitely meant a lot of men stayed home, but all of a sudden they felt like being the caregiver for my child is an option rather than something I need to farm out because I need to be unemployed as short as possible. And at that point, maybe they saw that this situation works really well for our family, and they stayed that way. And that wouldn't have happened if not for the changes of acceptance of men as caregivers, slowly being accepted as caregivers, and that more and more women have options in terms of a job that can actually support a family.
So are you saying you think that this trend would have happened with or without the recession, or are you saying that it opened up an avenue that a lot of dads were eager to take up on?
I think it's a little both. I mean, every family story is different. And I'm certain that there are a lot of men who were suddenly put in this position not by choice at that point, and they thrived in it. Or the experience changed their perspective about whether this was something that men can or should do. We're treated in a lot of ways, or have been, as like men are naturally incompetent at this sort of thing. And then they realize, even if they went back to work as soon as possible, then there's one more man out in the workforce who realizes, number one, how hard it is to be a stay-at-home parent, but also number two, that it's not something that is somehow beneath a man to do, or that they are incapable of doing it. And I think the more people in society that just realize that, which is usually through their own personal experiences or those of people that they know, I think it just becomes a more equitable world where families can, function the way that they choose, the way that works best for them, rather than feeling constrained by gender boxes.
Right. And you were saying before that society is slowly shifting. You said slowly a couple times, and it made me think. I was doing some research for our talk today, and I saw that the term stay-at-home dads auto-filled with the words are losers on Google. That's not what I was Googling, but it popped up. So is there still a stigma today about being a father who stays home with kids?
Yeah, absolutely there is a stigma, and I think that we have to be honest with ourselves that there will be for some time. However, there's still been such significant shifts that even that, that kind of statement obviously comes from a place of ignorance as opposed to a place of being the standard idea about fathers. Because we do talk now about how good it is for children to have their fathers be involved. We talk a lot about absentee fathers and how that can affect a family. And so I think that people are practical enough to say, even if I don't understand their choice, even if I don't think I could do it myself, or whatever their reason is, when they look at a dad who is really hands-on and involved with his kids, even if he's not a stay-home father, we see that as a healthy thing. We see that as being good for that family in much larger numbers than we ever have before.
Talking right now to Chris Routley, board member of the National At-Home Dad Network, talking about news that more stay-at-home dads are there by choice. And Chris, your group, the At-Home Dads Network, is trying to provide support to dads who stay home with their kids maybe full-time. What kind of support do you think that fathers like this need?
Well, we have four pillars of our organization. We try to do as much advocacy as we can to kind of speak out for fathers, whether that's talking about, media portrayals and how that, can really affect how people see things. Everyone's familiar with the sitcom dad, the bumbling father. So calling that kind of stuff out. We try to help them find community, whether that's in a local group where they are of other dads that they can find, or a virtual community online. So a lot of guys going to the role of stay-at-home dad, and they're in a small town somewhere, and they don't see any other fathers out in the playground, and it can be very isolating. So it's really important. We focus on education for them to help get them resources for just how to be a better dad or a better parent in general. And we offer support in terms of, especially at our at-home dad convention, what we call Home Dad Con, where they can just, you know, just being in a room with 150 other guys who get it can really play a very strong role in helping them to see value in what they do, to know that they're not alone in the areas where they struggle, all that kind of stuff. So it's kind of a broad spectrum of what people need, and we want to do our best in order to fill those needs.
So when you are in a room with 150 other at-home dads, what do you hear from them about the toughest thing about being in that role?
Overwhelmingly, people talk about isolation as the toughest thing. And how difficult it is to kind of do something about that really depends on the individual dad's circumstances. Often geographic circumstances is a big part of that. But that is the main thing, is that when you take on this role, it usually doesn't take very long before you realize, you know, I can't sit at home with the baby. I need to get out. I need to have adult conversation. And you realize that it can be really, really hard to find for a dad who shows up at the playground and is, you know, treated, sometimes literally asked if they're a predator, you know. Or you go to the library for story time and they call it Mommy and Me, even though they say everyone's welcome. Like, those kinds of messages make people feel like this is not a space where I am welcome. And they have to decide at that point, you know, am I just going to give up looking for support or am I going to build something or what they're going to do? That tends to be the biggest struggle.
Now, my kids are still little and I can remember being home more often with them than I am now. And I know that there are these networks of moms that build up. People approach each other pretty openly at groups and on the playground. What kind of advice do you have for dads at home who do want to network? Just what should they do?
Well, I feel strongly that embracing the role and being proud of it can have a huge effect, you know, especially amongst friends and family and where you are. I mean, we talk about the awkward party that you go to and someone asks, what do you do? And when you say you're a stay-at-home dad, that can often just shut down conversation. So people will fall back on what they used to do or what they, you know, what they're planning on doing later. I found that when I stopped apologizing for what I did and talked about how it's the hardest and the best job I've ever had, to talk about it like a job, treat it like a job, and, you know, and try to be professional at what I do, the people around me picked up on that. And at that point, it became a lot easier, I guess, to find other people who saw me and got to know me a little bit and weren't kind of put off by the fact that I wasn't the mom, you know. So you also have to be very accepting of the fact that sometimes those people just are not ready, you know, and you move on. And, you know, I went on a lot of first dates, I guess, with dads where we'd meet up with our kids and go and do something and I'd never see them again. And that happened, but, you know, getting online was a really big help for me. And, you know, when I finally found the At Home Dad Network and I could, you know, be writing to people and in discussion groups talking about stuff without having to just sit in the playground and hope another dad shows up, you know?
Talking to Chris Rowley right now. He's a board member of the National At Home Dad Network. And we're talking about news that more stay-at-home dads are there now by choice.
And we want to hear from you. Are you an at-home dad? Call in at 800-642-1234. And if this is you, did you make the choice to stay home, or was it the work world that forced you into it? Did you start it because you were out of a job and then decide, hey, this is right for me? What do you like about being a stay-at-home dad? And what do you think people get wrong about it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're picking up our conversation with Chris Rowley. He's a board member of the National At-Home Dad Network. And we're talking about the news that more stay-at-home dads are there because they want to be.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? Are you an at-home dad or is there one in your family? Did you make the choice to stay at home? What do you think about it? Do people get it? or do you get weird looks and weird comments? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And let's go to our first caller. We've got Lauren joining us in Green Bay. Lauren, hi.
Hi.
What is your story?
Yeah, my wife and I moved to Green Bay about 5 years ago when our daughter was 3 months old for a new job to a new area. And we didn't know anything about childcare in the area or job availability for myself. And my wife asked me if I would be interested in being a stay-at-home dad. And at first I was kind of floored by it. I was like, wow, it's not something I'd ever thought of doing. And then I started doing it, and it was really hard. 'Cause, you know, as any parent of a new child, newborn, knows, like, it's just, you know, you kind of learn as you go, and it can be really difficult. And then being the only one there doing that stuff is hard. And then learning a new area, and the director of that national organization mentioned that kind of going to the park and feeling kind of weird or awkward, being the only guy there with a kid. That's been me multiple times.
And so it's been a little while, it sounds like. How's it going now? How do you like it?
I really enjoy it. I've tried a few times to go into part-time work, and sometimes it will work well with our schedules, and sometimes it doesn't. And then after our second child was born, about 2.5 years ago, I was working, and then it didn't work to be part-time and find childcare to cover when my wife was at work and when I was at work. So then I went essentially back to being a full-time at home. And then I offered myself up as a kind of a backup babysitter to some friends. And then that kind of turned into now I provide some childcare for friends at my home. And actually I got to check on one in just a minute. And get a little upset.
I heard little voices in the background. Well,
yeah,
great.
Sorry.
Oh, go ahead, Lauren. What did you want to add?
Oh, no, the little stuff of life. I picked up my oldest from school, and we played at the park, and it was, again, hanging out with all the moms that were there, but I'm now part of PTO at my daughter's school, and there's two other dads on PTO, the executive board, so her school is a very active, a lot of dads active in the school, too, which is kind of cool to have as well.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much for calling and sharing all that with us, Lauren. And Chris, there's a picture of Lauren who's kind of dipped his toes in the water, surprised him that he, you know, this was an option. And he's really expanded his interest in it and helping out other friends, an active role in the community. Is that the kind of story that you're hearing more of lately?
Yes. I mean, his Lauren's story is very indicative of most guys. And you know, we asked a question about, like, is this a choice or is this like an economic necessity? And sometimes that is very muddy waters because there's a lot that goes into that choice. You know, when Lauren talks about coming to a new town and not being able to find a job or not knowing what's available, to some people that would be he couldn't find a job, so he stayed at home. But it really comes down to a practical choice. And for them, it was what was going to work best for our family. Ultimately, it was for him to be at home, that finding some work could absolutely, you know, contribute to the family's finances, but they make a value choice about saying what really means a lot to our family, and her income is better than his, or he has a more flexible work schedule. So it's those kinds of things that may be connected to employment, but not really a cut and dry, he's doing this because he lost his job or is underemployed, which tends to be the stereotype about stay-at-home dads.
Well, Lauren, thank you so much for that call. And we go next to Bill, who's with us in Milwaukee. Bill, hello.
Well, hello. You know, my story is pretty much, I was working in television. I got laid off, and we did the numbers. My wife had a better job than I did. The cost of daycare was kind of like prohibitive. So that kind of elected me to be the stay-at-home dad. Ends up, I'm like working in the workforce now. My kids are graduated from high school. They're in college. My youngest is in college. My oldest graduated last year. And my experience with staying at home ends up training me for this job I have at the Simple Soymen, making tofu and other natural stuff. I mean, like, I've got, like, this awesome kitchen sense. It's just, no, really. And then, you know, I mean, sure, my wife really certainly managed our family really well, being so intuitive that she is. But, no, it was really satisfying. But, you know, but the stigma of being the stay-at-home dad, you know, like, yeah, that was certainly a thing. And what you were mentioning before about, you know, like, how do you explain what you do, you know? But every woman that I talked to was like, you go, man. That is so cool. I don't know. Sorry, I didn't mean to just ramble.
It's all right, Bill. I like your enthusiasm. You're obviously really happy, and things turned out really well for Bill, too. He's got a vocation, a new one, I should say, that grew out of what he did with his family, raising his family. But I want to zero in on one part we haven't talked too much about is the cost of childcare, Chris, because we had a couple callers mention this now about how that was a factor, too. Is the cost of childcare part of the story we're telling here?
Absolutely. Yeah, we just had our at-home dad convention last week in Portland, and as part of the registration, people fill in, you know, the reasons, you know, they can check more than one, but that applied to why they are in this role. And about a third of the people who came to the convention said that childcare being too expensive played a role in their decision as a family. So that's absolutely something that you know, is on people's minds. It is very tough to be a single income household for anybody. And then once you start having kids, that childcare can really add up. And so you crunch the numbers and discover, simply economically, it makes more sense for someone to be home quite often so that you don't have that. You know, you don't want somebody working just so that they can be paying for childcare, right? And instead, they get to be with their kids and get all the value from that as well. So definitely a big factor.
Well, thanks a lot, Bill. Appreciate that. As we talk to Chris Routley, who is a board member of the National At-Home Dad Network, and we'll take another call now. Ashley is with us in Coloma. Ashley, hi.
Hi. I was curious as to what was most difficult for your guest transition. Now, I went from being a full-time worker when my husband and I got together and through our first child. And then after our second child was born, we decided to homeschool, and I stopped working to be a stay-at-home mom. And the hardest thing for me was trying to find value in the everyday work that you do at home with the kids, when for so long your contribution is a monetary one, and you can see that pretty instantaneous with bills getting paid or savings and stuff like that.
Interesting question.
Yeah, about a year or so to be okay with, you know what, being a parent is more than enough of a contribution.
Ashley, thanks so much. I'm glad you brought that up. Is that something that has to shift for moms and dads, Chris, as you go through this, thinking that your contribution isn't something that has a dollar attached to it anymore necessarily?
Absolutely. You know, there's still a lot of people who hold on to this idea that a man's primary job is to provide for his family. And so there definitely is this period of adjustment and kind of intentional, you know, work you have to do yourself to understand that provision is more than money, you know, that our kids need our time more than they need things that we can buy for them. You know, that really what you contribute, even simply what I contribute towards my wife's ability to pursue her career, is to her really valuable. You know, there's a lot of kind of assumptions that when you're a stay-at-home parent, especially a stay-at-home dad, there's a lot of talk about once the kids go to school, then you're off the hook, you know, and that you'll go back to work. And it was actually when my eldest started into kindergarten that I realized how much my being home was still adding value to our family, despite the fact that at least one of my children was out the door for 6 hours a day, that all of the practical necessities of having kids at school to drop off and pick up that fall both within an 8-hour work shift, right? Or being called to the school for various things, that the fact that my wife doesn't have to leave her job and come and deal with anything. She doesn't have to worry about sick days when one of the kids are sick.
And we got to leave it there. Chris, great conversation. Thanks so much for joining us. That was Chris Routley, author and illustrator and board member of the National At Home Dad Network. You can leave your comments on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
Yesterday, we talked about fall camping in Wisconsin, and you weighed in on the social medias with some of your favorite places to camp and things to eat while you're out there.
Teresa says Winoka Lake and Moose Lake are fantastic. Plus, she says, National Forest campgrounds all the way. People who go there know what they're doing, and they don't leave things out for raccoons and other creatures. No lights, no electricity. Just awesome.
Chris says, way up north, we were in Minocqua in late September. Nobody else in the campground. We could skinny dip, let the dogs run, and I had a conversation with a curious loon of the avian type. Chris also has a food recommendation, a foil pack with sliced potatoes, baby carrots, lots of fresh herbs, a stick of butter, a little water, seal it up, steam it up, and then you open up a little so to let some smoke in toward the end.
Mm. And Christy says, a great camping food over the fire in the fall or anytime is an apple sliced almost all the way through with an apple slicer set in foil, and then have different toppings to add. Caramels, she says, red hot candies, brown sugar, nuts. Place the wrapped apple on fire and cook until hot and soft and toppings are melted. So good.
Let's get a fire pit built outside here, and then just at, you know, when we have lunch, we could just go down and do our foil packs and steamed apples.
Sounds like it's a great plan. Yeah. I see no problems with it.
No flaws at all. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.